Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. And welcome to March. We are now in the month of March, and I just got back today from Colorado Springs, Colorado, where I was giving another one of my seminars for the AAAI-ISMA Fitness Organization. So I was at the beautiful Broadmoor Hotel again. So it was nice to be out there, but we got a lot of snow this year and like 1 degree when I left this morning. So it was pretty cold. So I just stayed inside the whole time. I didn't go outside at all. But the seminars went good, and so I'm happy to be home. All right, today on the show, we have an interview with Doug Brignoli. And Doug, for those of you who know your bodybuilding history, was one of the top amateur bodybuilders in the 1980s. He competed several times in the AAU Mr. America, winning his class. And Doug has stayed in shape over the years. And I remember when I was working for Ironman magazine, he did a photo shoot when he was older, in his 50s. And Doug is also an expert on muscle physiology and kinesiology, and he understands how the muscles work. So the second part of our interview, we talk a lot about how you should construct your workout program to get maximum results. So he has a lot of interesting things to say about that. All right, before we get to that, I want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning Fat Burner Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banut and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right. Well, the other big news, of course, over the weekend was the Arnold Classic. This was the 30th anniversary because that contest started in 1989. So it has been 30 years now since the Arnold Classic started, and it was bigger than ever. I was watching a little bit of it from my hotel room in Colorado. I had a live feed. Redcon One was the main sponsor, so they had a live feed that was on YouTube. So it was pretty cool. I got to see the strongman event, and Thor from Game of Thrones won the second time. This guy's an absolute monster, 7 feet tall, 400 pounds. So that was good to see that. I saw the event, the final event, which they did on stage Saturday night. And one of the guys was lifting this huge stone, and he dropped it, and it started rolling off the stage. It rolled right towards Arnold, who was sitting in a chair watching it. And Arnold, being the action hero he is, he got out of the way in time. So we almost lost the great Arnold Schwarzenegger getting hit by a stone. What a way to go. But he got out of the way. But the contest itself, I accurately predicted the winner, which was Brandon Curry. If you listened to last week's show, I gave my predictions. And I figured Brandon Curry, his time had come. This guy's got great genetic, great potential. And at the Olympia last year, he really showed a lot of promise. So I figured by the time of the Arnold, he was going to make enough progress and he was going to be the surprise winner. And he was. So last year's winner, William Bonick, was in second place, and he looked fantastic. He was hard as a rock. I don't think he could have been any better, but just his structure holds him back a little bit. He's kind of short and kind of not blocky, but he's not really as wide or as big as Brandon Curry. So that's the one thing that holds him back. But that guy's an incredible bodybuilder, and he looked fantastic. So those two guys, it was down to the wire, and William Bonick did win the most muscular award. And then third place was a real surprise. It was Luke Sandow, who is a new guy, pretty much. He's really made a lot of progress, and he was posting a lot of progress pictures on his social media, and he looked fantastic, but I thought he was going to place about sixth, and he moved all the way up into third. So congratulations to him. He had to be super happy placing in the top three. And then Cedric McMillan, one of my favorite bodybuilders, of course, was a disappointment again. Usually he nails it at the Arnold and he misses it at the Olympia, but he was way off. He almost looked off season. So he only got fourth. And fifth place went to Rowley Winkler, who was third at the Olympia, but he was also off here. And we figured that because everybody saw the video of Rowley posing a couple of weeks ago and he looked way off. So I figured he wouldn't be able to get it together in time, and he couldn't. And then sixth place went to Steve Kuklo, another surprise. So Steve, that's probably his highest placing in a big contest like the Arnold. So congratulations to him. I thought Josh Lenardowicz would be up there, but he wasn't. I'm not sure where he placed. I think Victor Martinez was in the top 10, so he really didn't place as high as he thought he was going to place either. But it looked like an exciting Arnold. I wish I could have been out there. I haven't been out there in 3 years, but hopefully I can make it next year. But this conference seems to always come on the same date as the Arnold Classic. So we'll see what happens next year, but I'd love to go out there again. It's always a great event. And then Sunday, of course, I think is one of the best days because Arnold has his champion seminar. So he's usually being interviewed by Bob Ciccarillo. And this year they did something different. They brought Arnold on stage with, I think it was Lee Haney, Jay Cutler, Phil Heath was there. A lot of different Mr. Olympias. I think Brandon Curry, of course, was there because he was this year's winner at the Arnold Classic. So they had about six or seven guys up there. And I think Franco was there, of course. So it looked like a great event. I wish I could have been there. That would have been the highlight for me. All right. What else? Oh, had a little excitement at my seminar on Saturday. I was doing a seminar on bodybuilding, and it was pretty well attended. We had a lot of people there. And there was two young ladies there who were from Colorado, I think, and they were asking questions. And one of the girls pulled out a salad, a kale salad, and she was eating the salad during my seminar. Then she went to ask me a question. She started choking on the salad, and she couldn't stop choking. So she eventually went outside. She got up and went out into the hallway. And then we heard her choking, and her friend followed her out into the hallway. And she looked at me, and she said, she can't breathe. So I ran out there, and I gave her the Heimlich a couple times. And then she was able to finally breathe and drink some water. So I saved somebody with the Heimlich. So it was an exciting weekend for me, too. So hopefully, all kidding aside, she's all right, and she got it down. So it was a little scary for a second there. I never did that before, but everything worked out okay. And then I'm also disappointed because my mom and dad were supposed to come out and visit me in Tampa. They were out at a cruise that they left out of by Orlando, and then they were going to come over here. But unfortunately, my mom fell and broke her wrist during the cruise, so they went straight home. My dad drove straight from Florida all the way home, and they made it back in one day to Chicago. So he's an animal, but hopefully my mom will get better soon. So that was a shame. I was looking forward to seeing them. All right. So that's it for the news. All right. Let's read some of the emails we got last week. I got an email from Pat Comer, a guy I used to actually compete with back in the 1990s. And Pat's a big fan of the show. So he said, hey, John, I just started listening to your Martinez interview, Mark Martinez, the one I interviewed last week. And he said, you're speaking of the Robbie Robinson interview. Robbie had lost his hearing in one ear during an accident while he was in the Army. He talks about it in his book, The Black Prince. I've read it many times, and I consider it one of the best books in bodybuilding. All your interviews are great, and I appreciate your hard work. Oh, okay, well, that explains why Robbie had trouble hearing me in our interview that we did with Rick Valente. And then speaking of Mark Martinez, I got an email from Mark, and he thanked me for doing the interview last week, and he said it was great. And then he talked about Doug Brignoli, who was our guest this week. And he said, Doug is so immersed in kinetics and physiology now, and I feel would be a very important figure in this field. I'm not sure if you ever read the Lonnie Teeper article Back in the Game in Iron Man about Doug. It's amazing what Doug came through after achieving a great deal of success. I'm not sure if you ever read Sam Fussell's Muscle, but the character named Raul is based on Doug. And the gym Shangri-La was actually Brignoli Fitness. I'm looking forward to hearing you speak with Ken Sprague, who I have an interview scheduled with Ken Sprague, one of the former owners of Gold's Gym. So that's coming up soon. And Mark was the one who set me up with that. So thank you, Mark. And Mark said, like John Balick and Charles Gaines, Ken is probably one of the most articulate men I've ever met. You and I are historians. And as you know, bodybuilding does a good job of not caring about its history. Ken is a major figure that for some reason is never mentioned or mentioned enough. Without him buying Golds, history would have looked a bit different. All right. Thank you for that email, Mark. And thanks again, like I said, for setting me up with that interview with Ken Sprague, which I'm going to be doing this week. I also got another email here, and he says, John, I was listening to the Mark Martinez podcast, and I can't wait to see his documentary. Guys like him and you are so great for the sport. I love when he described the first time seeing a real bodybuilder as being kicked in the chest by a horse. I've told you before that that's how I felt as a teenager at Gold's in Mississippi, seeing the owner, who was basically a national-level competitor. He was huge. I haven't had the chance to write, but I also wanted to mention how much I was truly impressed with the Ed Corney podcast. You produced that so well, and tying it together with the story at the end was awesome. I'm telling you, if they had Emmys for podcasts, that one would be in the running. Oh, thank you. It was that good. Also, I love Robbie's interview, and having Rick Valente there made it even better. They were free and easy and telling stories. Robbie sounded so upbeat and was genuinely having fun, I think. He's hanging in there, and as I've said to him on Facebook more than once, he continues to inspire. It's always amazing to me when he responds. Social media has so many negatives, but it has been amazing to an old 80s gym rat to be able to actually interact with some of my heroes. Tom Platts tagged me, responding to a comment about leg day. Tom freaking Platts. Thanks for continuing what you do. It's greatly appreciated. All right. Thank you for that. And yeah, I agree with you about Robbie. When I got off that interview, Rick Valente texted me and he said, not too many people get to see Robbie being like that. And like you said, he was very free and easy. And unfortunately, he got sick right after that. So I hope he's doing well. He seems like he's posting a lot on social media. So hopefully Robbie's getting better and his health will be coming back. All right. So that's the emails we got this week. Thank you guys for sending those to me. And if you ever want to email me about any of the shows we do, I appreciate all your comments, negative or positive, or any suggestions you might have, or any guests you might want to hear from. Just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And like I said, you could also check out my YouTube channel, which is under my name, John Hansen, and be sure to subscribe to that if you get a chance. All right, before we get to our interview with Doug Brignoli, I also want to mention we are brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, is just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number, which is 813-922-8939, or you can just reach them on their website, which is flalternativemeds.com, flalternativemeds.com, and mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation to see what you need, and they'll also give you 20% off your order. And if you want to call them directly, again, that number is 813-922-8939. And they have a fat loss supplement also called the Magic Pill. So you can also order that when you give them a call, or you can go on their website. All right. So that is it for our opening. Here is our interview with Doug Brignoli, where he's going to talk about bodybuilding in the 1980s and competing in the Mr. America. Here we go. All right. Welcome to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And today on this show, we have a very special guest. His name is Doug Brignoli. And Doug was one of the top amateurs in the sport during the early 1980s. He competed as a teenager, and he was also Mr. California winner and a very top placer in the Mr. America. So, Doug, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be here.
All right. Yeah, I know you've got a great history in the sport, including training with the legendary Bill Pearl. So I wanted to talk to you. It's been overdue to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad you thought of me.
Well, Doug, let's start at the very beginning. I know you competed as a teenager, so what got you into bodybuilding? What was your inspiration?
Well, we're talking 1974, 1975. I mean, we didn't really know much about the benefits of weight training back then.
Right.
I wanted to gain some weight. I was very skinny as a 13, 14-year-old kid, and I asked my junior high school coach, what I could do to gain weight, because I was trying to, eat fattening foods, thinking that would help me gain weight. He said, well, you don't want to gain that kind of weight. Mm-hmm. You want to gain muscle weight. And the only thing that'll do that is weight training. So prior to that, I had always thought that exercise of any kind was for people who wanted to lose weight.
Hmm. Okay.
This concept of gaining weight by exercising
right.
was pretty new, especially to a 14-year-old kid. So I looked it up and found some bodybuilding magazines at the store, the bookstore, and said, wow, this is pretty cool. So I went to, I happened to live in Pasadena. I happened to live 4 or 5 blocks from Bill Pearl's gym, although I had no idea who Bill Pearl was.
My
mom was a member of that gym, but it was also known as the Pasadena Health Club.
Oh, okay.
So the sign would say Bill Pearl's in tiny script above, and then below that in big letters, Bill Pearl's Pasadena Health Club.
Okay.
So, I mean, he knew that was a better market. He knew that was, you know, more of an audience than the bodybuilding audience.
Right.
So that gym was set up so that the bigger front area was carpeted, had chrome weights, you know, had a lot of, you know, the stuff that was in vogue at the time, those roller machines, the vibrating belts and things like that. But in the back, he had the linoleum floor and the heavy weights, the squat racks and things like that, you know, no pros.
Okay. Yeah.
So I went there and I was 14 years old and I said, I'd like to work out here. And he says, how old are you? I said, I'm 14. He said, we have a limit of 15. Can you come back next year? So I said, okay. So in the meantime, I went and I had my mom buy me one of those plastic cement filled plate sets, 110 pound barbell set. And, you know, it came with a little booklet.
Right.
I started at home doing my, you know, bench presses and my whatever I couldn't do with the weights, I would jimmy rig with, you know, springs on a wall. I would do, you know, tricep push downs with springs on a wall. And, you know, I copied the exercise I saw in the bodybuilding magazines. And then the following year, when I was 15, I went back to Bill Pearl's gym and I said, I'm 15 years old now. And he said, okay, well, it's $180 for the year. I said, well, I thought it might be that, but I can't afford that. I was wondering if you'd let me work for you in exchange for membership.
Oh, okay.
So he said, sure, come on in every Saturday and I'll put you to work. And so he would have me clean the shower area and sweep the parking lot, polish the chrome machines. And I would do that every Saturday and I would earn my week's membership in advance. So that's how we started. And within a year.
Did you know anything about Bill Pearl when you were working for him, Doug? I mean, did you know that he was a Mr. Universe winner and all that?
Well, during the year that I waited for him for me to turn 15 years old, I kept reading the magazines and I put two and two together and I realized that this guy down the street is the same guy in these pictures. And this is a legendary 4-time Mr. Universe winner.
Yeah.
And so by the time I went back, I did know that he was a bodybuilding champion. I did see, obviously, the trophies that he had at the gym and then, you know, some pictures on the wall. Obviously, I was very impressed. But I was also, but I've always been kind of the skeptical kind of person. In other words, I don't tend to worship anyone, regardless of their accomplishments. So, you know, I was impressed that he had accomplished that, but I didn't necessarily automatically assume that everything he said was quite exactly correct.
Yeah.
So okay. I would ask him questions, and I think he quickly realized that I may not follow his advice. He's like a father figure to me.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you started reading the magazines, did you have any goals of, you know, that you wanted to compete and eventually win Mr. America or anything?
No. My original goal was really just to gain weight. I just wanted to be closer to normal than I was.
Yeah. What did you weigh, Doug, when you were 14?
111 pounds.
Wow.
So I weighed 111 pounds before I started doing my weight training at home.
Okay. Oh, yeah,
that was
really
like
skinny.
I must have been like 13 then. And by the time I was 14, by the time I started with Bill Pearl, I must have been about 120, maybe 125.
Okay.
And then within a year, there was a sign, a poster in the back of the gym that was advertising a bodybuilding contest, a small local contest, the Mr. Compton contest, which is just basically a city contest. And they had a teenage division that said, you know, teenage Mr. Compton, I think they might have had, I don't know if they had a seniors, but anyway, so by this time I was putting on a tiny little bit of muscle. I was weighing about 135 pounds and some friends kind of encouraged me to do that. I asked Bill, what do you think? He said, absolutely, jump on in there and you can see what you can do. So by that time, it was only 2 weeks before the show. It was no point in trying to diet. So I kind of went in as is, but I tended to stay lean. I'm an ectomorph kind of by nature. So, you know, which is why I was so skinny to begin with.
Right.
But I had good definition in my shoulders and chest, and you know, as skinny as I was, I had some clarity. So I ended up taking second place, which of course was very encouraging to continue. But what really encouraged me to continue was the fact that at that contest, there was a writer for a magazine named New West Magazine.
Okay.
And New West Magazine was just sort of a society magazine, kind of like what might be like now we call it Los Angeles Magazine or something, or California Magazine, just general topics, entertainment, trends, things like that. And he was there to do a story on this phenomenon at that time called teenage bodybuilding.
Wow, that's interesting.
And so he was fascinated with this concept, with this idea, so he thought it would make a good story. So it just so happened that he fixated on me. I didn't win. I took second place, as I said, but there must have been something that he saw in me in terms of personality or rapport with the people I was talking to. This kid seems kind of interesting. So, and he didn't need the first place guy. He just needed somebody who was doing it.
Yeah.
To tell the story. So he wrote a 7-page article in this magazine with pictures of me and Bill and pictures of me and Jim Morris and pictures of me with my mom at home eating, working out, and just basically telling the whole story about, you know, first of all, how bizarre bodybuilding was at the time by itself. And,
yeah.
and let alone even more strange was this idea that now teenagers were getting involved.
Yeah. What year was that, though?
1976.
76. Okay. Wow. Yeah. I tell people all the time, because I started competing in 79, and I tell people how big teenage bodybuilding was back then. And they have a hard time believing me, because now today the numbers have dropped off to almost nothing. But back in the 70s and 80s, it was really, really big.
Yeah, I think in 76 when I did this, I think this was really like at the very, very beginning of the teenage division's popularity.
Yeah.
By the late 70s, early 80s, it had become extremely popular.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
In fact, I'll go so far as to say you that Lee Haney and I both stood on the Teenage Mr. America stage.
Oh, that's
different
right.
Divisions,
yeah.
Different
yeah.
divisions, thankfully, in 1979.
Right.
And then, of course, he went on to win Mr. Olympia.
Now, there was a – I saw a thing on 60 Minutes, the old one with Arnold. You remember that? And it was came out in 1977, I think, and that was when Pumping Iron came out. And you were in that, right?
Well, that was so bizarre because for those who don't know what that reference is, it was a 60 Minutes story on Arnold.
Yeah.
And it was just talking about, you know, just how new this was, this thing, this – cult-like thing called bodybuilding, and how Arnold was really the king of this cult.
Yeah.
And so one of the things they were talking about was this concept of posing.
Yeah.
And how posing can be very graceful and very elegant, and it's choreographed. And then, of course, they showed some clips from Ed Corney doing his posing routine.
Mm-hmm.
And then they show me from a 1977 Teenage Mr. California contest.
Wow.
Which I was completely blown away by because they certainly didn't latch on to me because of my physique.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be entirely because I was demonstrating good posing skills.
Yeah.
At 17 years old.
Wow. You were only 17 there. I thought you looked really good.
I was 17. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh. Now, where did you learn how to pose like that, Doug? Was that from Bill Pearl?
No. In fact, I didn't really see Bill pose even at 17. My idol was Frank Zane.
Okay.
And then of course I also saw Ed Corney pose,
but
you know, I'm sure you agree with this, that today's posing just sucks by comparison.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, totally.
I mean, it used to be an art form. And now there's just so many competitors that there's not enough time
to really give
everyone the 90 seconds we used to have. And now it's just a matter of just looking at you. And by the way, you can't really compare people unless you're seeing them side by side in the same pose anyway.
Right.
So the assumption back then was that if you had a couple of people that were very, very close to each other, but one guy was a great poser, the other guy wasn't, then you could inch him out from the great posing. But at the very least, it was an opportunity for us to really display what we had created in the most flattering way, not just with mandatories.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I like that you mentioned that too with that 60 Minutes piece, because they did talk about how the posing was a really important part of the sport. And of course, in the book Pumping Iron and the movie Pumping Iron, they also talked about that. And like you said, they used your video to demonstrate that. So yeah, it was a whole different era back then.
And I would say even now, I mean, if someone asks me, you know, should you compete or should you, I would say, yes, you should definitely compete. And don't concern yourself too much about your placing. Concern yourself more about your presentation, and that would include your posing.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that you're doing something really, really memorable, something really that you can be proud of for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Videotape it, photograph it, because this is your creation. That's the bottom line. Most important thing is this is your creation.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about some of those other teenage shows you were in, Doug, during the late 70s.
So this magazine, Newest Magazine, just really lit my fire. And I thought, oh, God, well, what am I going to do now? So so I did the 77 Teenage California, which is what that video is, in Arnold's 60-minute clip. And then I waited a couple of years because I thought, I've just got to put some muscle on.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1979, at the age of 19, I entered the Teenage Mr. California contest and the Teenage Mr. America contest. Actually, two different Teenage Mr. America contests, which I'll tell you about in just a second. The Teenage California was an AAU show in Fresno, and I took first place in my division, but didn't win the overall. But back then, you might recall, they used to give body part awards.
Mm-hmm.
So I won best arms, best legs, best abs, most muscular, and best poser. The only thing I didn't win was best chest and best back. And the kid that won did have more thickness than me. And so I don't begrudge him for taking the overall. I was very pleased to have won what I won. Then I went to the Teenage AAU Mr. America and placed third in my division.
Yeah.
Different division than Lee Haney. I think Frank Pantoja took first place in that year, in that division.
And you beat out Phil Williams that year, right? Who went on to win the Nationals. Yeah.
I did, and I didn't even know it. I was pretty oblivious. I was sort of in my own world. And then one of my friends told me that Chet Yorton had a Mr. America, natural Mr. America, which had a teenage division here in Los Angeles. It was called the NBA, Natural Bodybuilders Association. And I entered that and took first place in the teenage division in that.
Right.
I don't know how long the NBA lasted. It's obviously not around now, but I don't think it lasted too long.
Uh-huh.
And so that was, and when people would ask me, like, how long are you going to do this for? At the time, I said, well, I don't think I'll do it beyond my teenage years.
Right.
But,
really?
But I just thought I can't do this forever, and I don't want to be Mr. Olympia, but.
Yeah.
And I figure I got to get a job someday.
Right.
So, but you know, something happens to you. You just get addicted, right? So once you win a national teenage contest, you think, I can't walk away now. If I won a national teenage contest, I should at least try my state contest.
Yeah.
So well, I waited a couple of years.
You had to be inspired too by Frank Zane winning the Olympia during those years too, because you know, he was your idol and you modeled yourself after him. And Frank was the best bodybuilder in the world back then.
Well, and if the physique like his, which was kind of like mine in terms of not huge, but
right.
really symmetrical and really lean and really artistic, if a guy like that can win a top title,
then
maybe I can win, you know, an amateur state title.
Mm-hmm. At least, yeah.
So so I entered the AAU Mr. California in 1982. I was 22.
Okay.
And I weighed 184 pounds at 5'10". So I was not big at all. And I wore a warm-up suit. You know, they was a little bit baggy. And I remember going backstage into the Mr. California contest.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys were overwhelmingly big. I was pretty intimidated. And I remember Ray York was in the heavyweight division. He just looked like a monster backstage.
Yeah, I remember Ray York. He used to compete in the Chicago area, too.
Ah, okay. And I didn't know anybody by name or by face. I just knew there was a lot of beef backstage.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very intimidated by it. My friends had come with me, and I took my warm-up suit off. And actually, before I took my warm-up suit off, somebody said, hey, buddy, the swim team's down the hall.
No way.
Because I didn't look like a bodybuilder in a warm-up suit. I looked like a swimmer, I guess.
Right.
And I took my warm-up suit off. My buddies came backstage, and they were just freaked out at how lean I was.
Really? Wow.
And, it's the leanest I've ever been to this day. I was really, really, really shredded. And you know, I had to be really, because I didn't have much size, so I had to have something that was, you know, dramatic. So I ended up winning my division and winning overall, beating Ray York, as well as the other division winners, and also winning the most muscular. And I thought to myself, well, I can't quit now.
Yeah. The Mr. California was a big title back then.
Yeah. I mean, Bill Pearl won it. And I mean, Larry, I don't know what other, I think Larry Scott may have won it. I mean, the list of Mr. California winners is really impressive.
Yeah. It was usually a predictor of who was going to win Mr. America, right?
Kind of. Yeah. It's a pretty competitive state. So, So I entered the 1983 Mr. America, which is which was in Tampa, Florida. That was the year Jeff King won. But there was just no beating Jeff King.
Right.
He was still is one of the best bodybuilders of all time. I mean, he had the size and the definition and the symmetry. And I was in his division. I took fifth in my division. But it was packed. I mean, the everybody who was anybody at that time was pretty much in that, you know, Billy Arlen and Rick Poston. And that was just in my division. There were, you know, monsters in the other divisions. And so, I was, you know, humbled.
Were you intimidated at all, Doug, going into that, into the Mr. America?
Extremely. It was my first Mr. America contest, and these guys were monsters. And I remember seeing, Jeff King sitting on the floor. He's a very nice guy, very modest, and he was sitting there with his warm-up suit on, and I could see the mass on his arms and shoulders and thighs. And you know, I had, you know, try to coach myself to not get intimidated, to never, because, you know, we know that sometimes you see a guy in the gym and he looks really impressive, and then he ends up really bombing out on stage.
Just doesn't look that good up there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the examples, not so much about bombing out, but, you know, I remember Dave Johns worked out of Bill Pearl's gym in Pasadena, and he was so large and so impressive in the gym, and he would get on stage and he wouldn't look that good. He didn't have separation. His biceps wouldn't peak. He wasn't ripped. You know, he had, you know, he had long legs, short torso, long arms. So a lot of these things aren't apparent when you're looking at someone up close. And then when you look at him at a distance, you go, oh, well, especially next to someone else. And you can see these flaws. But so I looked at Jeff King sitting there and I thought, well, he's big, but maybe he's not ripped. I was wrong. He was ripped. So yeah, I was intimidated, but I was, you know, as I said, humbled, and I was appreciative of what I needed to do to if I was ever going to win that title. I shook Jeff King's hand and congratulated him. And, he was trained by, I think you remember, what was his name? Back to the trainer from the East Coast,
Bob Gruskin.
Yeah, Bob Gruskin. But he also knew how to pick him, right? He wouldn't take anybody on that didn't have great genetics.
Right. And Jeff was young, right? Wasn't Jeff like 22 or 23 when he won that?
Exactly. Yeah. 22 or 23, he was just huge. And then he won the universe after that. And I think NABBA, but he was never allowed to compete in IFBB because he had to come up the NPC ranks. And he refused to go down into the regional levels of NPC after having won an international title. And I don't blame him.
So, yeah, he was one of the most impressive Mr. Americas ever. I mean, to this day, people still talk about him. People remember him from back then.
Yeah,
you know, he's
legendary. I mean,
yeah.
And he had this monstrous neck.
Yeah. He had 22-inch neck.
And he never worked his neck.
Really? Wow. Yeah. His legs, like, rivaled Tom Platt's, but he had a great upper body, too.
Yeah. He had amazing calves, amazing quads. He was just... just really just nailed it right on the head.
Yeah, the gym I was training at the time in the 1980s, a lot of those guys from that gym, or a lot of the guys from the Chicago area, the top guys, they all went to the 1984 Mr. America the year after. And everybody was, you know, talking about Jeff King, like, this is the standard we have to rise up to. And it was just, you know, that guy was just, he was legendary.
And that,
like,
was, and that was Joe Miko, right? 1984.
Yeah. And you did the commentary on that, right, Doug? Weren't you doing that for ESPN?
Yeah. It was interesting because, you know, I had planned on opening a gym right after competing in the 1983 Mr. America. Mm-hmm. And so, I said, well, I didn't do as well as I thought I would do in the Mr. America, but I've got this plan, so I'm going to do this. So, I was working out of Bill Pearl's gym, but Bill Pearl's gym had been sold to another guy. And I was hoping that, that I would be able to open up the gym sooner. But as it turned out, Bill Pearl's gym closed because the guy who bought it from Bill Pearl just basically ran it into the ground. And so that meant that the my local gym was no longer there. And if I went to any other gym while I was working on opening my gym, I would get the evil eye because everyone knew I was going to be opening up a gym soon. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to travel out of town to go work out, but that was too much of a hassle. So I didn't work out for an entire year.
Really? Wow.
Before the 1984 Mr. America contest had rolled around. And so I didn't look anything like I looked a year before.
Right.
I hadn't touched the weight in a year.
Wow. So there were
a couple of people who saw me walking around at that contest and said, "Hey, you look familiar. Do you have a brother named Doug Brignoli that competes?"
Wow.
I go, no, that's me. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah. How'd you get the commentary gig on ESPN?
Well, it was just luck because Pasadena was my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened that I had traveled all the way cross country to Florida the previous year to compete. And the following year, it's in my hometown.
Yeah, right.
Right. Figures. That's the year that I don't compete in it. Right. But since I was here, and I don't even remember what the connection was, but obviously you needed to be here to be a commentator. Yet you needed to be at the contest. And having already won Mr. California and having, been in the top five of the previous years, Mr. America, it made sense.
Yeah.
To have me do the commentary, since I know the subject. So it was just one of those things at the right time at the right place. I don't even remember what the specifics were, but
right.
It just fell in my lap.
Yeah. Yeah, you did a good job with it. That was your first time. Because I remember watching that on ESPN.
Yeah, well, I mean, any you or I or anybody who has an opinion, and is articulate would have done a good job.
Yeah. So tell me about training with Bill Pearl when you met him. Like, what kind of I talked to Chris Dickerson before, and he told me, Bill put him on a program and he had him train every body part. And he was training, I think, 6 days a week. So how did Bill help you out with your training and your diet?
Well, as I said before, Bill learned very quickly that I was not someone who was going to follow every one of his recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and as you know, Bill was also a very short person, not stature wise, but short in terms of, talking. He was not chatty.
Yeah.
Right. He was very short in his commentary, right? He was very sort of succinct.
Yeah.
And so he didn't really invite me to train with him so much. He was always, always, always kind and sweet and generous with me, and I trained with Jim Morris. I trained with Chris Dickerson. I trained with Dennis Tenorino.
Wow.
Jim Morris was my actual training partner for a number of years.
Oh, no
the other
kidding.
Guys I mentioned, yeah, I mean, we worked out, like, we met at the same time, same every day, 5-6 days a week. I mean, we worked out regularly. We were training partners.
Yeah.
Which was ironic because he had already won Mr. America and I was 16 years old.
Wow. That's
I
great.
I was just a kid.
Yeah.
Or I think by that time I was, 17 or 18 by that point. I was always watching what people were doing. I would watch when Bill Pearl would train. I would watch when Dave Johns would train, and just, curiously trying to break down what it was they were doing. And I've always had, that kind of mind where I kind of want to figure out what the objective is, the lowest common denominator of a thing is. So for example, if you're doing a curl, and you're going to compare a curl with, let's say, an upright row, you say, okay, well, these two things must have something in common, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're both meant to develop muscle.
Yeah.
So what are the common denominators, right? So, I was always sort of mechanically inclined. So I would say, well, the objective of an exercise seems to be to bring the insertion of a muscle towards the origin of the muscle, to maximally shorten it and to maximally elongate it.
Mm-hmm.
So then I would say, so I can see that happens when you do leg extensions, when you do leg curls, when you do tricep pushdowns, but I don't really see that happening when I'm doing upright rows. What's actually happening here? So I'll tell you later what I discovered, but the point was that I was much more analytical about stuff than most people. Most people would just sort of say, well, Bill Pearl does it, I'm not going to question it.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do it, where I would always question it.
Right.
And ultimately, you know, I ended up, even at the age of 16, making some very, very profound discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
Like at 16 years old, I learned, even though I didn't know the name of it, I learned what a resistance curve was. For those that don't know what a resistance curve is basically what happens to a lever when it travels the arc around a pivot point.
Okay.
So let's say you're doing a standing curl and your forearm is the lever, its pivot is the elbow. When that forearm is vertical, when it's parallel to gravity, it's a neutral lever. It's zero. It's not loading the bicep at all,
right,
as long as it's in that vertical position. It starts to increase its load on the bicep when it starts to move towards a horizontal position.
Right.
Okay, so that sequence of going from zero to 100% when it's horizontal, and then if you were to continue doing a curl so that the forearm is pointing upward and the hand is right over the elbow, you've traveled back to a zero neutral position again,
mm-hmm.
right? That's physics. That's the way levers work, right? So
right.
I used to do forearms on a bench, and I noticed that I felt a little bit more resistance than I wanted to at the stretch part of the range of motion. And I would bring my hands up into the contracted position, and I would feel less resistance than I wanted to feel. Somehow I intuitively knew I wanted less here and more there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I quickly realized that if I just prop up the back end of that bench behind me and angle my forearm so that it's not horizontal, so that it's actually slanting slightly down from my elbow to my hand, that I can add resistance to the top of the movement and take it away from the bottom.
Hmm. Okay.
That was a very simple adjustment I made that made the exercise more comfortable and seemingly more effective. But what I had actually found was this resistance curve and how you can manipulate a resistance curve to better coincide with the strength curve of the muscle you're trying to work.
Right.
So that was just one of the many things that I sort of observed, you know, and then little by little, I started developing just a whole series of mechanical sort of do's and don'ts.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you know, you could look at all exercises and say, they can't all be equal. They can't all be, because they're not all mechanically the same. So if you're going to be able to differentiate between a good one and a bad one, you have to be able to identify the mechanical things that make that change happen.
Right.
Right. So we now know that muscles are stronger when they're stretched, when they're elongated.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to compare that, what I just said, to a tricep kickback,
mm-hmm.
you realize that when you start the movement and your elbow is bent and your forearm is hanging vertically.
Right.
You are at a zero resistance position, even though your tricep is in an elongated, strong position.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not good, right? And then as you extend the arm, the forearm gets more horizontal. It increases its load on the triceps precisely as the tricep is getting weaker.
Hmm. Okay.
Right? So that's completely backward from the strength curve of the muscle. You're going to get too much resistance at the end and not enough at the beginning.
Right, right.
So some people would say, well, you know, it's just a different resistance curve. Why not do them both? And I'd say, why do it at all? Why not just do the better one?
Right. Gotcha.
Why waste your time with an inferior exercise that literally deprives the muscle of any resistance precisely at the point when it's the strongest?
Right. Okay.
These are parts of the reasons why I didn't really look to Bill Pearl, as much as I adored him and respected him as a person and as a businessman and as a bodybuilder. And to this day, I am eternally grateful to him and just adore him.
Yeah.
I was not inclined to look to him for what I would think was scientifically sound or the best scientifically sound information on how to build muscle.
Okay. So Doug, how did you change your physique then? Because you're starting off as an ectomorph, very skinny. What kind of training, and especially the nutrition, what did you do to eventually build that muscle and become a Mr. America competitor?
Well, again, I've always, you and me and all of us, you know, whenever we're competing, we're always looking for answers. We're always looking for information. We're looking for an edge and advantage. And sometimes the right information is available and sometimes the right information isn't. Sometimes the information that's available is sort of right, but not 100% right.
Right.
So, you know, I did the conventional wisdom, which was to eat as much as we could possibly eat in the off season.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, 3 months before the competition, you cut back on something. You've got to cut back on one of your two fuel sources.
Right.
Now, protein obviously isn't a fuel source. You've got to cut back on either carbs or fats.
Right.
Because those are your fuel sources. And the belief back then was that you need your carbs because that's where your glycogen comes from. So we were all eating zero fat. We were eating dry baked potatoes, dry rice, rice cakes, dry chicken, skinless breast, you know, the lowest fat fish we could eat.
Right.
And ironically enough, that works. It works in the sense that you're going to be able to get lean on it, depending on a few biochemical things that may or may not be going on in your body.
Yeah.
So the main thing you're doing when you're cutting back on your dietary fats is you're cutting down your calories.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And at the end of the day, calorie consumption matters a whole lot when it comes to getting leaner.
Yeah.
Now, if you happen to be someone who produces too much insulin when you eat carbs, that diet may not work for you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're one of those people that doesn't produce much insulin when you eat carbs, as I was back then you are actually able to get pretty darn lean. Maybe not as perfect as you want, which is to keep the muscle and lose the fat.
Mm-hmm.
Now I do something dramatically different because now I do tend to produce more insulin when I eat carbs.
Okay.
And if I eat too many carbs now, I end up with low blood sugar.
Hmm.
And what I didn't know back then, which also mattered less back then, which matters more now that I'm older, is that we definitely need some healthy fats
right.
in order to produce our hormones.
Right.
Right. So I was in a real funk up until a couple of years ago because I was not eating enough dietary fat and
mm-hmm.
I was eating too many carbs and I was having an insulin response to the carbs. And I kind of bombed out at the last couple of years of competition because of that fact. I was having a metabolic problem, didn't even know it. And now the conventional wisdom is, in fact, to eat more healthy fats, olive oil and avocado and things like that, and less of the starchy carbohydrates.
Right.
And I'm going to compete again this coming October.
Are you really? And okay.
I think I'm going to do better now.
What's the show you're going to go into, Doug?
Well, I'm not committing myself to it 100% yet because I need to see how this goes over
okay.
the next few months. But if all goes well over the next few months, I'll be doing the over 50 NABBA Universe in Manchester, England.
Oh, nice. Very good. Cool. Tell me a little bit more about some of the other guys you met when you were younger during that golden era of bodybuilding in the early 80s and late 70s.
Yeah, it's funny because in looking back now, I realize how lucky I was to have met some of these people.
Yeah.
I mean, I became really, really good friends with Shigeru Sugita.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who was from Japan. He'd won Mr. Japan. He'd won Mr. Universe. He was at Bill Pearl's gym because he was visiting with Bill Pearl, of course.
Yeah, that's right. I remember seeing pictures of that.
We worked out at Bill Pearl's gym and we became very, very good friends and we used to go to the beach together and then years later I think he was at Bill Pearl's gym. It might have been around 1970, I don't know, maybe 7, 8, 9, right around
mm-hmm.
there or something.
Right.
And then in 1985 he invited me to go to Japan.
Huh,
and
okay.
all expenses paid, put me up at a hotel, did an exhibition and a seminar at a contest that he was promoting there. And so that was just one of the benefits of meeting a legendary champion when you're a teenager.
Wow, that's amazing.
But I met Boyer Coe, as I mentioned Dennis Chinarino earlier.
Yeah.
I met Reg Park in Croydon, England at the 1991 NABBA Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just there in the back room, and I couldn't believe my eyes. There he was, Reg Park.
Yeah.
I met obviously Samir Banut. You know, I met him when I was 19 years old, competing for Teenage Mr. California. He was good friends with another bodybuilder you may know named Ed Holmes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember him.
Yeah, so Ed Holmes didn't get to too high of a level, but he was friends with Samir. And then, you know, Ed Holmes came to my hotel room, Holiday Inn. We were all in the same contest, so we were all sort of hanging around, and he introduced me to Samir Banoot. Samir Banoot had not yet won Mr. Olympia, but he was the nicest guy in the world. I was very impressed. He'd already won Mr. Universe, just not Mr. Olympia.
Right.
And then, of course, later, you know, you're even more impressed. I know that guy.
Yeah, right. How about Boyer when you met Boyer?
Boyer came to my gym. I had opened up my gym in Pasadena in 1984.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I don't remember the circumstances of how he ended up going. I have a picture side by side with him, both of us flexing our biceps. But I have no idea, no recollection of how it ended up, how he ended up there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he just dropped in one day and announced, or if he called me, or.
Right.
But there he was. And the same thing with Dave Draper. He came by my gym and visited with me. We took pictures together. But
wow.
I don't have any recollection of how that happened, how he ended up there.
Yeah, those are both two great guys.
Yeah, legendary. And, of course, Ed Corney.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the best of all time. And I met him somewhere. I saw him frequently then later at all the Olympia shows.
Okay, yeah.
Sitting at the table.
You had to meet a lot of guys with your gym in California, because that was the hotbed, you know, that was the mecca of bodybuilding.
It was those two things. It was being a gym owner. It was also being, you know, a relatively high level amateur bodybuilding competitor.
Mm-hmm.
It was the association with Bill Pearl.
Yeah.
And it was being in California, which is, you know, kind of, you know, the proximity of Golds, the proximity of Weeders.
Yeah.
You know, all of that.
Did you ever want to compete in the IFBB, Doug? Was that one of your goals?
No, you know, for some reason, it never appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. I guess it was because, in part, I never thought I had the genetics to allow me to have enough mass to compete against, you know, the pros. I never even had an ambition to be a pro bodybuilder.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I always thought that, you know, my ectomorphic structure would limit me to having, you know, too small of a physique.
Mm-hmm.
And I could almost see, well, we all could see really, that, you know, although Frank Zane pulled off a three-time Mr. Olympia win, you know, in his later years, he was shunned by guys who had less aesthetic physiques but were bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you could see the trend moving away from symmetry and more towards mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just even further discouraged me. I just figured I would just be happy with my amateur universe division win.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing when you look back at the sport how much the standards did change. You know, when Frank was winning during those years, it was like they really regarded symmetry as very important and posing was very important. And then, like you said, over the years, it just gradually changed towards more mass.
You know, one of the things that people ask me, I'm sure they ask you the same thing, is why is it that bodybuilders look different today?
Mm-hmm.
than they used to look in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I we can only speculate, right? It can only assume that the reason why bodybuilders in the 70s, 80s, 90s had such distinctive looks, like you could look at a silhouette of a bodybuilder and you could identify that bodybuilder just by the silhouette.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right? Not so today.
No.
And I think it's because what happened was that in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, although steroids had come into vogue in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they were not as prolific as they are today.
Right.
And so I think what happened is back then, you had to have good genetics to start with.
Mm-hmm.
The anabolics maybe would help you, but it wasn't the whole ball of wax.
Right.
Now, you don't have to have good genetics to be big.
Right.
Right. And so now you get anybody and everybody who just juices up and they get huge and they become competitive because of their hugeness, but they didn't have the kind of genetic aesthetics that was a requirement back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Yeah. And it almost seems like the bodybuilders back then always had that in mind when they were developing their physique was they, of course, were always working to get bigger, but it was always a matter of how it looked together, you know, the whole symmetry, the whole package. And they had to have the definition. Everything had to be in proportion. Those things were very important. It wasn't just building more and more size. Everybody, of course, always wants to get big.
Yes, I was absolutely arts oriented, aesthetics oriented.
Yeah.
And that's why the posing was much more dramatic. The music was much more elegant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything was more graceful back then. We really all, I think, unanimously considered it an art form.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas today it is absolutely not considered an art form.
Yeah, I remember going to some of the Chicago shows and it'd be like a state level show or a regional level show where there were some really good top competitors. And if a guy came out and he was doing his posing routine and he was very graceful, it was like it got the respect of the audience. You could even hear the other competitors yelling out, you know, just how great it was. Because that was part of it. That was part of the deal. You had to be a really great poser. That was part of the respect you got from the other competitors if you did that. You know, if you didn't do that, I think you were looked down upon.
Yeah. And you know, look, I mean, I've worked with a lot of bodybuilders, and no matter how hard you work with them, no matter how hard they try, they cannot be graceful posers.
Mm-hmm.
They just can't move that way. And so when you do see someone like Muhammad Makawi or Francis Benfato, you know, or Samir Banout, and they do these poses and these transitions that are so magnificent. There's just no other way to describe them. I mean, they're just majestic.
Yeah.
You know? You are mesmerized and impressed to a degree that you can't be impressed by just muscle mass alone.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, we just did a tribute show for Ed Corney after he passed away on the podcast.
Good.
Yeah, and I got a letter from one of the persons who, one of our fans who listens to the podcast, and he said he was at the 1980 Night of the Champions, and he said Ed was in like 7th or 8th place after the prejudging. And then at the night show, he came out and he posed to Frank Sinatra's New York, New York, and just tore the house down. Got a standing ovation and ended up taking 5th place. And he said it was one of the best memories he could remember of bodybuilding. You know, it was just incredible. It was like the highlight of the night.
And that's why I tell people, look, you know, you cannot influence who's going to show up and who's not going to show up.
Right. Right.
So you can't let your placing in that event determine whether you're happy or unhappy with what you brought to the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You're going to bring your best. You're better than you've ever been before. Hopefully you're bringing a beautiful, graceful posing routine to the stage, which you can be proud of. You're going to get beautiful pictures. The idea that if no one really, really good shows up and you win, and that makes you happier than you would have been if you would have brought the exact same condition to the stage, but better people show up. Well, you can't determine your happiness level based on who shows up.
Right.
Right? You got to be happy with what you brought to the stage. And there was, I don't know if you remember, there was a motivational speaker years ago named Bob Richards.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Richards was an Olympic pole vaulter. He was also a preacher.
Oh, okay.
And he, I used to listen to one of his motivational speeches on tape, on cassette tape. And he would say, there can be victory in defeat and defeat in victory. Depending on how much effort you put into your preparation.
Yeah.
If you win, but you didn't give it your best, you've essentially lost.
Yeah.
But if you take 2nd, 3rd, or 4th place or no placing at all, but you did your best, you are a winner no matter what.
Right. That's true. And I like also what you said, Doug, too, earlier about how in today's competition, because they have all these divisions, the guys really aren't allowed to do the longer 90-second posing routines, and they're not really allowed to expand on that. And it is sort of robbing today's competitors of really, you know, developing their posing routine and creating a very dramatic presentation.
You know, I think even if you can't use the posing routine as a deciding factor over placing, you know, bodybuilders don't just prepare for a competition just for a trophy.
Right.
You know, they do it because their friends and their family are coming, and there's photographers there, and you're going to record this for posterity.
Yeah.
Right? You want to see today, tomorrow, next year, 10 years from now, how you looked on that stage.
Yeah.
And part of that is how you moved.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so important, too, because, you know, when you're younger, you don't think about it, but time goes by and you always wish you had those pictures or that video of when you were in your 20s or 30s, you know, and you were at your physical peak. You always want to look back on that, you know?
Yeah. By the way, speaking of pictures and videos, you know, since you and I are from the same era, you know, it's I always think about how lucky we are today to have had any pictures taken back then.
Yeah, that's true.
Because pictures were all related to film back then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, for someone to take a picture of you, they had to have their camera with them, not their phone.
Yeah, exactly.
They had to have
their
camera with them. They had to have film in the camera. They had to then take that film to a developing place. Mm-hmm. They had to develop that film. They had to give you the pictures.
Yeah.
The fact that we have any photos at all is lucky compared to how easy it is today to get video or photos.
Oh, I know. Totally.
We cherish those photos today.
That's why we're lucky to have Artie Zeller in the gym at Gold's Gym when it was at their peak and Arnold was training there with all the guys. And think of all the classic photos he took.
Yeah, and at the time they're taking those pictures, they don't know they're going to be classic photos.
No, they don't even know how it's turning out when they're taking them, right?
Yeah,
they don't realize, right?
They don't know it's going to be part of the historical legacy.
Right. No, not at all. Hey, Doug, tell me about the 86 America, because I think you just posted a picture, right, of that pose down when you had the top class winners.
Right.
That was a great picture.
Yes. Well, so the 86 Mr. America was won by Glenn Kinnear.
Right.
And that was in, I think it was in Houston, Texas.
Okay.
And I won first place in my division. Phil Hill won first place in his division. I think my division was medium tall. Phil Hill might have been medium division.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tall division was
Marlon
Darden, and then Glenn Kinnear was in the short division.
And
you know, it was a hell of a show. I mean, we're talking about everybody, you know, at the time bringing their best.
Yeah, those are four great class winners.
I think any one of us theoretically could have won without any kind of backlash.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I think it was almost a coin toss. And then we went to, most of us, I don't think Phil Hill went, but the other three of us went to the universe
mm-hmm.
2 weeks later. And that was, in fact, that's kind of an interesting little side story, but it was in Tucson, Arizona.
Right.
And Chris Dickerson was doing the commentary for that.
Yeah, I saw that on ESPN too.
And Bill Pearl was one of the judges.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I couldn't help but wonder anyway, what Bill Pearl was thinking. He's judging me now.
Yeah.
11 years. Yeah, 11 years after I started scrubbing his showers for him and his membership.
Right, right.
And now I'm on the Mr. Universe stage. Marlon Darden won the Universe that night.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Kinnear, we don't know who second and third was, but we won our divisions.
Yeah.
And it was another good contest, you know. It was just a good showing.
Mm-hmm.
You remember who promoted that show, don't you?
No, who was the promoter?
That was Carlos Rodriguez.
Oh, was it? Yeah, yeah. He was from Arizona.
And, you know,
that's right. Yeah.
He passed away, I don't know, what, mm-hmm. 5 years later or something?
Yeah, he was a great champion. I loved his body. He had a great bodybuilding physique.
Great champion and a great guy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what did you think of Glenn? Because I know Glenn from back in Chicago. When I was a teenager, I used to look up to Glenn because he was competing in the Mr. Chicago, Mr. Illinois contest. He was like the first real bodybuilder I ever saw. So I was really happy to see him win that contest.
He's the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I, from an aesthetic standpoint, I would say that he's too blocky.
Mm-hmm.
Not, and this of course has nothing to do with Glenn as a person.
No, right.
It's no different than me preferring, you know, Frank Zane over Lou Ferrigno.
Yeah.
You know, it's just an aesthetic that I like. I like, you know, the smaller, more curvy, more ripped,
mm-hmm.
more symmetrical, but you know, he had a lot of muscle. There's no doubt he had the muscle packed on that short frame.
Right. Great leg development too.
Yeah. You know who else you might want to hear about is Mike Dayton.
Oh yeah. I remember Mike.
Well, Mike Dayton promoted the 1991 AAU Northwestern Mr. America contest.
Okay.
In Oakland, California. I went up there and I took first place in that division. But you know, I didn't know Mike before then,
mm-hmm.
but I became really good friends with him at that event, and you know, he taught me how to tear a phone book.
Oh, really? That's wild.
which is not to say that you don't have to have any strength, of course. But there is a little trick,
right?
To getting the thing started, and once you get it started, the rest of it is sort of easy, but. You know,
okay.
The people that maybe don't know Mike Dayton, he was a Mr. America winner. And then he used to do all kinds of strongman acts. He would hang himself with his
hands
tied behind his back, and then somehow find his way out of that, you know. And he would break railroad, you know, those big nails they used to hold down. He would bend those and tear license plates. He had a huge. So he was one of my favorite bodybuilders of that day.
And how did you meet him, Doug? He came to your gym?
I just met him there. I met him when I competed at the show he's promoting.
Oh, okay.
But we've stayed in touch ever since. He's just one of my favorite people.
Is he still around today?
He is. Yeah, he lives in there. He's pretty much out of the game.
Yeah.
And his sister, Laura Dayton, is very much in the fitness world, but as a writer.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember her name. I didn't really realize they were related.
Yeah, Laura Dayton is quite accomplished as an author.
Huh. Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was amazing. And Bill Pearl used to do a lot of those strength acts too, right? Like,
yeah,
tearing license plates in half.
Yeah. He would blow up the hot water bottle.
Yeah, like Franco did.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's an interesting perspective, I think. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, and probably also still today, you know, I think there was a conflation. We do this today where we conflate physique and quote-unquote raw power, raw strength, right? So it's no secret that little boys, you know, want to be superheroes.
Yeah.
Right? It's no secret that, you know, men in their 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, would love the idea of being, you know, hyper-masculine. And hyper-masculine to some degree includes doing like very impressive acts of strength, like tearing license plates and phone books and squatting, you know, 600 pounds and deadlifting 700 pounds and all that. But, you know, in my book, which is called The Physics of Fitness, one of the things I say, which I think is very important, is that when we conflate these two, we basically compromise either one or both. And by compromise, what I mean is, because as you know, my focus on training is all about physics. It's all about getting the most for the least.
Okay.
Right? In other words, if you look up the word efficiency in the dictionary, you'll find that efficiency means getting the most with the least investment, right? Bodybuilders tend to brag about how much they squat, how much they deadlift, how much weight they put on the leg press.
Yeah.
So today, example, I just saw a guy who shall remain nameless, posting a video of himself leg pressing 1,000 pounds. And so, you know, I concern myself with that because I think to myself that there's far more to lose than to gain by doing that to your skeleton. That if your objective is to win a powerlifting meet and you're going to win prize money or a trophy or recognition for moving a huge amount of weight, and that's the objective, then fine, then pursue that path. But if you're not pursuing a trophy for that accomplishment, and the most you can get is to say bragging rights or, you know, Instagram posting, right? And your objective is more to have a good physique, build the most amount of muscle. It would be a disservice to you to use so much weight that you're compromising your skeleton and your joints and your spine, so that then that building your physique later becomes more difficult.
Yeah, right? That's so true.
I'll give you an example of just a basic exercise, which is the barbell squat.
Okay.
Earlier today, we talked about how a pendulum is neutral when it's hanging vertically. And when that same lever is horizontal, it's at maximum, right? Whatever amount of resistance you're using to hold it in that maximum position will be maximized when that lever is perpendicular to gravity, which is horizontal.
Okay.
Right? So when you start a squat, if you're looking at someone from the side, and they're about to start a barbell squat, you see that their lower leg is vertical and their upper leg is vertical and their torso is vertical.
Right.
That means all three of those levers are neutral, right? Whatever muscles those levers will be moved by are not loaded yet, right? It isn't until you start to bend your knees and that lower leg starts to move towards a horizontal direction and your upper leg bone, your femur starts to become more horizontal and your torso starts to bend forward. When those levers move towards horizontal, they load the muscles that move those levers.
Okay.
Okay. And the more horizontal that lever is, the more that muscle is loaded.
Okay.
Which means the less horizontal that lever is, the more vertical it is, the less those muscles are loaded.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're talking percentages here. All right. So when you start a squat and you look at someone from the side and they're in the fully descended position of the squat, you'll see that their lower leg has dipped forward from the vertical position, but only about 30 degrees. It has not even reached the 45 degree angle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a 45 degree angle would be 50% halfway between neutral and max.
Okay.
And that lower leg isn't even at 50%. Okay, that means that whatever's on your back weight-wise is only loading your quads with about 30% of what it could load it, because your lower leg, your shin, is still more vertical than it is horizontal. So you're not getting nearly as much quad load as you think you're getting. So what you do to compensate for that reduction is you put more weight on the bar, and that compresses your spine more.
Right.
The other thing we should look at is most of the time when someone is squatting, their torso leans farther forward than their lower leg does.
Right.
Which means their lower leg is loading whatever muscles it's loading, which is the lower back, more than the lower leg is. We don't do squats to work the lower back. We use it mostly to work the quads and the glutes.
Right.
Right. But yet you're going to notice that most of the time people load their lower back more with a squat because their torso is leaning farther forward than their lower leg is.
Hmm.
So now someone could say, well, but look at the upper leg bone. Look at the femur. The femur is completely horizontal, right? Shouldn't that be a 100% lever? And that's being moved by the gluteus? And I would say, well, theoretically, yes. But the fact that the lower leg is doubling under that upper leg bone, it's reducing its effective length. There's two things that load a muscle. There's two things that magnify resistance. One is the length of the lever, and the other is the angle of that lever relative to the direction of resistance. So instead of having a 17-inch femur magnifying the load to your glutes, you end up with only about a 9-inch femur loading the glutes. And again, this is percentages, right? So since you know that you can use more weight to load the glute more, you add more weight to the bar.
Right.
But the fact is that if you were to, using a different exercise, if you were to allow that lower leg to get more horizontal, as if when we do a sissy squat, for example, that lower leg goes way forward. And so you're getting a much bigger percentage of that load on your quads than you do on a regular squat. But as soon as you load your quad more, what happens to that upper leg bone? It becomes more vertical, more neutral, and it loads the glutes less.
Yeah.
So the point I'm making, even though that sounded very complicated, what benefits the quads more benefits the glutes less.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Makes sense, especially when you think about the sissy squat.
Right. If you were to do, say, a deadlift, or better yet, a glute machine, if you were to allow the full femur length to operate the glute without any reduction from that lower leg, you would eliminate the involvement of the quad.
Right.
So you can work your glutes better and you can work your quads better by not doing a squat, by not doing a compound movement that moves both joints and involves both muscles simultaneously, because both of those muscles require a different direction of resistance.
Hmm.
And when you're doing a squat, you're using one direction of resistance for both, and both are compromised. And so then what ends up happening is you end up bragging about squatting 400 pounds or 500 pounds, but the only reason you can squat 400 or 500 pounds is because both of those lower leg bones are not working at maximum efficiency.
Okay.
It's almost like raising a car up with a crowbar and then bragging about raising up a car. Yes,
right.
You did it, but that's only because you're using leverage to your advantage.
Mm-hmm.
If you were training with the idea of loading the muscle more with less weight, you would load your skeleton and your spine far less. You'd have much more longevity you wouldn't have all these aches and pains. These, you know, look at Ronnie Coleman now. He can barely walk.
Right.
So this is, you know, it might not matter to someone who's 20 years old and feels invincible. And, you know, if they get hurt, so what, they'll just heal. But when we're 50 years old, 60 years old, 70 years old, it matters a whole lot. And if we have any sensibility about us at all, we'll regret having not been more thoughtful about how we weight train, you know, when we're younger, and been being consumed by this bragging right of having to say, I bench press this much, overhead press this much, squat or deadlift this much, never mind what's happening to the skeleton and the joints.
Right. So even though a sissy squat is not a basic compound movement, you're saying that technically that's better for developing your quads.
Yes. Now, I don't know how much time, I don't have how much time we have left and how technical you will allow me to get here, but yes, that's true. Now, when the quad is working, it's primarily extending the knee, right? So if I was your quad muscle and I'm extending your knee, I don't know what other muscle is working simultaneously. Right. So if the glute is also working while I'm working, I don't really know or care about it. I have one job to do. My job is to extend your knee.
Okay.
Right. The more I get loaded, either because you're using a heavy weight or because you're using your lower leg lever with optimum efficiency, meaning with a perpendicular resistance, then I'm getting what I need for my growth. A muscle is only going to grow based on load. It doesn't know how much weight you're actually using. It only knows how much load it's getting. And how much load it's getting is influenced by the mechanics of each exercise, by the lever angles and the lever lengths of each angle of each exercise. So yes, I mean, even though we've been told for years and years and years that you must do compound movements
in order to gain
mass, that is absolutely false. So let me take it one step farther. Okay, so I already told you that if I was your quadricep muscle, I don't really know or care if the glute muscle is also working. I'll add a little nuance to that. What I will say is I don't benefit as your quad muscle by having the gluteus muscle participating. However, I am compromised to a degree by the gluteus muscle also working. And the reason for that is because of a thing called reciprocal innervation, which basically means that your body is wired to not allow two opposing muscles to be loaded at the same time. So if you pick up a dumbbell and hold it in what might be considered halfway in a curl position, and you're loading your tricep is completely shutting off, whether you're aware of it, keeping your body from basically creating a conflict of interest, from interfering with the function of the bicep. Okay. So whenever you're lifting any kind of weight, whenever you load any muscle whatsoever, whatever muscle moves that same limb in the opposite direction is shutting off to facilitate what you're doing.
Okay.
The problem is that some muscles have more than one function because they cross more than one joint. So your quadricep has four parts. Three of those parts only extend the knee, but the fourth part crosses the hip joint and also bends the hip. It is a hip flexor. Okay. So when you're loading your gluteus muscle during a squat, the gluteus muscle is a hip extender. Hip extension is opposite hip flexion.
Right.
So you're causing your rectus femoris, the one quadricep muscle that crosses your hip joint, to shut off while you're squatting because the hip extensors are loaded. They've done EMG studies on this, and they've proven that the rectus femoris is less active during a squat than it is during a leg extension. You will get better quad loading without hip extending, without loading the gluteus.
Okay.
Let me take it one step farther. When you're hip extending, whether it's deadlifts, whether it's squats, whatever it happens to be, the gluteus muscle isn't the only hip extender. It's one of several hip extenders. The other two are the adductors and the hamstrings.
Okay.
The hamstring crosses two joints. It crosses the knee and it crosses the hip. And so its primary function is to bend the knee, but its secondary function is to help extend the hip. So that means that there's no way that you can load the hip extension muscles which are the glutes, quads, and hamstrings. When you're squatting, there's no way you can avoid involving the hamstring. But guess what happens? When you activate that hamstring, you are somewhat deactivating the quad.
Right.
So when you're squatting, you don't want your quad deactivated. So not only are there mechanical reasons why it's better to separate knee extension from hip extension, there's also neurological reasons, advantages in separating those two functions. The problem is that, you know, there's been so many people that have achieved magnificent physiques by doing squats and leg extensions and sissy squats and everything else. I'm waiting for the day that someone says, and I'm hoping to do this when I compete in November, if my physique is what I think it will be, I will be able to say, what you're seeing right now is a physique that is developed entirely without barbell squats, deadlifts, pull-ups, rowing. These are all exercises that are mechanically explained in my book as being less than optimal. You don't need to load up your body so heavily. Instead of bragging how much weight you actually lifted, we should be bragging about how much we loaded a muscle with how little weight.
Right.
That's smart training. That's efficient training. The only thing that matters to the muscle is that it be maximally loaded. And you can do that if you know how to train smart. If you do a barbell squat, that just isn't smart. That's actually inefficient.
Okay. That's really interesting.
I'm sorry that gets a little bit complicated and technical, but I'm telling you, this is stuff that has been under our nose, you know, for years and years and years, and very few people. When I explain this to a mechanical engineer, and my book, by the way, is endorsed by 12 PhDs.
Wow, I'm kidding.
Including, you know, people that have physics PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
Including one guy that's a evolutionary biologist, an anthropologist.
Yeah.
So these are irrefutable facts. I mean, the way we've been training has been grandfathered in, because that's how it started from years and years ago. It started with, you know, strength exhibitions, circus acts, and then it grew to powerlifting, and powerlifters became bodybuilders. And so there was an assumption that you had to have a foundation in powerlifting in order to become a bodybuilder.
Right.
But
right.
Logically and mechanically and neurologically, it just doesn't hold up.
Well, it's great information too, Doug, because for people like me or yourself who are getting older now and have been doing this their whole life, this is a safe way to train. And if you can, like you said, if you can show that physique when you get back up on stage, you'll be living proof that this stuff works.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody's got to start, because nobody wants to be the first one to try it.
Right, right.
Right. Everyone is afraid to go for a concert without doing what the tried and true is.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But somebody's got to start, you know, and then when people see one guy having done it, then there'll be a second guy and a third guy and a fourth guy, and pretty soon it'll become the norm. But until that happens, we're still using outdated methods.
Yeah, well, that's going to be really interesting to see. I hope you do it. I hope you do change things around. I'm going to incorporate some of that myself. How can we get a hold of your book, Doug?
Well, right now it's only a PDF. It's not in print form. We're expecting it to be in print in May. But you can get the PDF right now from me. Just email me at dbfitness@aol.com. That's my initials, of course, DB, the word fitness, spelled FITNESS, at aol.com. I usually get $50 by PayPal, and then as long as I've got your email address, I can send you the PDF.
Okay.
It's 800 pages. There's 900 images in the book.
Wow.
So it's thoroughly illustrated. You know, it is so logical. It's so, when you look at it, you don't have to have a leap of faith in any of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can literally prove some of these things just by looking at the mirror.
Yeah. Wow.
I'll give you one more example. I don't mean to, but
no,
if I give you a rope and I tie the other end of that rope to, let's say, a chair, and I tell you to pull on the rope, there's no way that you can pull that chair in any direction other than toward you.
Right.
You cannot pull it to the left. You cannot pull it to the right. If you are a muscle fiber origin, the only direction you can pull your limb is toward you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So if you stand in front of the mirror with your shirt off, with your arms outstretched, and you draw an imaginary line straight through your hands, shoulders, from one hand to the other, and you ask yourself, what percentage of my pectoral muscle is above that line or below that line? You realize there is no percentage of your pectoral muscle that is above your shoulder line.
Mm-hmm.
It is all below your shoulder line.
Right.
However, when you do an incline press, you're moving your arms in a direction above the arm line. You're moving your arms in the direction of your chin or of your nose.
Mm-hmm.
There's no pectoral fibers origins there. Somehow, we've been led to believe for all these years, every gym in the entire world has an incline bench.
Right.
And we were told it was going to work our upper pecs.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no pectoral fiber origins above the arm line. Because we're moving our arms towards our chin, at least towards our neck.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly if more steep chin, nose, right? So, and from an evolutionary standpoint, you know, we used to be quadrupeds. We used to walk on all fours.
Mm-hmm.
And little by little, as we evolved, we began walking more and more upright, right? So that means that our arms were always either pushing straight down or varying degrees of decline, but never incline.
Right.
From an evolutionary standpoint, there was never a reason for our arms to ever move in an upward angled movement direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no logical reason why we would have developed shoulder function or muscle function that would cause that. That doesn't mean we can't move our arms in that direction. I mean, there's lots of things that we can't do that we didn't evolve to do,
mm-hmm.
right? But if you do a flat dumbbell press, you're already moving your arms towards the highest pectoral fibers on your sternum.
Right.
And then varying degrees of decline will work the lower angles. So what I tell people is, look, which of these two makes the most amount of sense? Moving the limb towards a place that there are more muscle fibers or less muscle fibers.
Right.
Obviously, you want to move toward. So if you move your arms towards the middle of your sternum, right between the clavicle and the xiphoid process, you are creating a slight decline angle. That moves the arms towards the greatest number of muscle fibers. If you're going to do one chest exercise, it should be a slight decline angle.
Mm-hmm.
But you should never do an incline angle because it's, you might get a little bit of participation from the pectoral muscles, but it's almost entirely from deltoid.
Hmm. Wow. And the angle of the bench doesn't change that?
No. The angle. First of all, let me just say that the angle of the bench, when we're talking about free weight, right, assumes the straight down pull of gravity.
Right.
Right. So if you're at an incline angle, right, you're going to have to rotate your arms upward in order to move opposite gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, if you use cables, you can do a decline angle sitting upright. Just by having the origin of those pulleys slightly higher than your shoulders, and then you moving your arms in a direction that is slightly lower than your shoulders.
Okay.
So in my book, when I talk about decline or flat, I'm talking about a direction of the movement of your upper arms relative to your torso.
Mm-hmm.
Because you might be using cables. Right. So a lot of times you'll see someone who's doing, let's say, who uses an inclined bench on cables, but they're using cables that are not pulling from straight down. They're pulling from straight back and they think they're doing an inclined movement.
Right.
No, it's only an inclined movement if you're moving at an angle higher than your shoulder bones, than your shoulder joint.
Okay.
I mean, look, we're trying, you and I here at this moment, to explain something using only words and no visuals.
Yeah.
Right.
No, so matching
it's pretty
our heads.
Hard. It's pretty hard to grasp it, but it isn't at all hard to grasp when you're looking at it right in front of you.
Yeah.
Like if you look at an anatomy from the side, a male anatomy or a female anatomy from the side, and you put an arrow starting at the shoulder joint horizontally straight 90 degrees from the body, you can see that you're already moving to the highest parts of the chest fibers.
Mm-hmm.
If you draw an arrow from the shoulder joint at an upward angle, you can see you're moving away from the pectoral fibers.
Right.
You're moving towards the neck, towards the chin, towards the nose. But if you draw an angle from the shoulder at a downward angle, at 45 degrees, you see, oh, look at all the pectoral fibers I'm moving toward.
Yeah.
By the way, if you ask someone in the gym, or maybe yourself, how does your chest feel today from your chest workout yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
And then we typically flex our chest.
Yeah.
What do? We move our arm across our chest at a decline angle.
Right.
We never check our chest muscles by moving our arms at an incline angle ever.
Right. That's true.
That's true. Because that's not where the chest muscle flexes. It's not where it contracts.
Right, right.
You know intuitively where your chest muscle contracts, and it's somehow we've allowed tradition to misguide us and do these exercises that really are not sensible at all.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, sorry for being on a soapbox.
No, it's interesting stuff.
This is disturbing stuff, right? I mean, this shakes things up a little bit because...
Yeah, you're challenging conventional wisdom.
Yes, and many of us have, experienced a lot of effort and a lot of work and sweat and tears in mm-hmm. the gym, toiling, and we want to believe that everything we did right, and the reward is how we looked on stage. Right. Yeah. And you're going to say, well, look, Arnold Schwarzenegger did incline presses and look what a great chest he had.
Yeah.
And then I would say, well, yes, but what you don't know is how much each individual exercise he did contributed towards that look.
Right.
It would be wrong to assume that if he did, let's say, 10 different exercises for his chest, that all 10 contributed equally to that chest development.
Right.
The fact is that the decline angles contributed more and the incline angles contributed less, but you don't know that. All you know is the end result.
Right.
So it makes it even worse when those of us who have achieved some level of success in bodybuilding or in fitness then become trainers and then recommend other people doing the exercises that we have always thought were good, incline presses or squats or whatever. And then we now have to deal with the possibility that we were less well-informed than we could have been. That we have passed on that misinformation to other people. That we've contributed to the problem of not understanding, proper body mechanics. So that's why it's really disturbing, really shocking. It's kind of like, it almost shakes our identity a little bit to think that maybe we didn't know as much as we thought we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
This is psychology. This is human nature. We all tend to want to believe that we know all that we should know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a long history of, I don't know if you saw that movie about Stephen Hawking. When he was first coming up, he was doing these seminars and he was describing things that ended up being 100% true. Same with Einstein, by the way. But mm-hmm. along the way, there were lots of people that thought these guys were crazy.
Yeah.
Because people want to believe in conventional wisdom.
Right. Yeah.
Sometimes we were provided with better information and it's hard to refute when it's right mm-hmm. in front of you and it's very logical.
Right. Right. It's kind of like when Mike Mentzer and Arthur Jones came along and they challenged the high sets approach, with the high intensity approach instead. And they were met with a lot of resistance too.
Yeah. And sometimes an explanation seems very logical and maybe isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons, by the way, that I love body mechanics or biomechanics is because I can do a show and tell. I can literally make a model and I can prove to you that when you do this, this happens. And when I do that, that happens.
Right.
Very, very provable. When you're talking about physiology, it's not so provable. Right. And Mike Mentzer, by doing the, high intensity, what was the name of his course? Heavy duty,
yeah.
That is physiology, right? So from a logical standpoint, you could say, well, it does seem to be more logical that if you do a set that is twice as intense, that it might be as productive as two sets that are of half intensity,
mm-hmm.
right? That might make some sense. But the problem with physiology is that things aren't quite as simple as they are in physics and in mechanics.
Yeah.
Right. Because this involves, biochemistry and all kinds of things. And so now we know from studies and EMG analysis and all that, that you cannot entirely replace volume with intensity.
Right.
Right. If you bring super, super, super high intensity to a particular set with breakdown sets and forced reps and all these things, and you are causing high, high, high degrees of fatigue in that muscle. If you think that results in muscle growth, then you're buying into the notion that a muscle grows on fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out it doesn't only grow on fatigue. It might grow a little bit on fatigue, but what it really grows on is recruitment.
Hmm.
right? The more muscle fiber recruitment you get, the more you grow. And fatigue is one way of recruiting fibers. But another way of recruiting fibers is simply with heavyweight, low reps.
Right.
So, for example, if you do a set of 50 reps and you do it to failure, to absolute failure, the first, let's say, 40 reps didn't get much recruitment, but the last 10, especially the last two or three, would get very, very high recruitment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You would not get much recruitment until you got to failure on the high rep set.
Right, exactly.
But if you do a heavy weight for, let's say, 6 reps or 4 reps, you're getting high recruitment on the very first rep.
Right.
So then the next question is, so can I get as much muscle growth as possible with one super heavy set of 4 reps?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is no, because volume does factor into the equation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you can actually get more growth by doing, let's say, 8 or 10 sets of 4 reps, each of those sets being at 95% maximum effort. In other words, not to failure.
Mm-hmm.
Then you would get by doing half as many sets to failure.
Okay.
There's an author that I recommend people read. His name is Chris Beardsley.
Okay.
B-E-A-R-D-S-L-E-Y. He's out of England. He's done a lot of great research on muscle physiology. And what I just told you, I learned from him. So I'm going to give him that credit.
Okay.
My expertise is in biomechanics. I don't claim to be an expert in physiology, but I did want to bring that up because you know, the heavy duty thing and the extreme maximum fatigue thing simply has been disproven now. That if you want the most amount of muscle growth, there is some value in doing some high rep, low weight sets.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily as the prelude to the heavier, lower rep sets.
Right.
But you still need to do enough of those heavy sets in order to get maximum muscle growth. And you can't do enough of those sets if you're taking those sets to total failure.
Right.
So it's kind of a blending.
Yeah. That is interesting.
Yeah.
You've given us a lot to think about.
I'm sorry. Yeah, but you know what? I have to say that, you know, for those of us like you and me that love the sport, that love the art of it, that love the science of it, love the legacy, the history, the tradition of it, it's always nice to learn something new. And we want to feel that after spending decades in the sport, that we become better versed in that sport, and that the people that we talk to after that can then benefit from our decades in that endeavor.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and you've had a long career in the sport, Doug, and we look forward to seeing what you look like this year when you compete again.
Oh man, you're making me nervous now. I shouldn't have even announced it.
Take some photos either way, you know, whether you do it or not, just take some photos.
Well, that is the main thing I want to do is I want to do this training as if there's going to be a contest. So even if there is no contest, I am going to record. I am going to peak in October no matter what.
Right.
We'll get some photos of it, and I will demonstrate that this kind of training does produce as good a result as the more abusive type of training.
Yeah, I've been doing the same thing the last few years. I've tried to peak every couple of years, and whether I compete or not, I just try to record it and take pictures just for myself, you know, just see how
as I'm
getting older. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. All right, Doug. Well, thank you for joining us on the show. And we appreciate your interview. And hopefully we can have you back on again, maybe later in the year when you reach this peak, and we could talk about it some more.
Okay. Thanks. So good. Thank you so much for the opportunity, John. I appreciate it.
All right, Doug. Take care.
Okay. You too, my friend. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you for listening to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast for this week. Thanks to Doug Brignoli for that interview. And next week, we're going to be joined by one of my childhood bodybuilding idols. I'm really, really excited about this. Glenn Kinnear, who was the 1986 AAU Mr. America. I'm going to be talking to Glenn, and we're going to talk about the old days of bodybuilding. This guy was a real inspiration to me when I was only a teenager growing up in Chicago. So it's going to be a real honor to talk to him. I can't wait. So join us next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you then. Take care.